Welcome, everybody. This is All About Symbian Insight podcast number 208, recording this, and hopefully you're hearing this on Tuesday, the 27th of March, 2012. I'm Steve Litchfield, and with me up in Hull, I have...
David Gilson. Hello, everybody.
And down in deeper Sussex, I have...
Rafe Blanford. Hello, everybody. It's great to be here.
I don't know why I said deepest. It's glorious sunshine all across the UK today, so...
It is. The daffodils are looking fantastic. Spring finally seems to be here and the clocks have gone forward, so it feels like it's spring properly now.
So everybody down to race for a barbecue, I think.
Absolutely.
A few items of news and analysis and basically debate. First of all, there has been a Nokia Store client beta update again. They seem to do this every 2 or 3 weeks, Rafe. It's now version 3.24.053, which is a bump of 003 from the last beta, I think. And they're probably edging towards another formal release, I'd say. I get the feeling in my bones, Rafe, that probably another 2 or 3 weeks and we'll see this rolled out over the air. When people launch the store on their device, they'll get this particular version. Do you think that's about right?
I think you're right. I think also they're probably preparing to ship this one with Bell Feature Pack 1, which is going to come with the Nokia 808 PureView and will probably be uploaded on the over-the-air on the sort of Generation 2 Symbian 3 devices as well. Now, they tend to go on roughly a three-monthly pattern for those kind of updates. In this latest beta, it's more small fixes rather than anything else. But one thing I did want to mention, it's not strictly Symbian, but I think it's an interesting one with regard to Nokia's store more generally, because people have been wondering what's going to happen to that, how long is that going to go on. And I keep saying it's going to keep being updated, it's going to keep happening, because actually it's really important for the Series 40 strategy. The reason I remark on that in particular is the last update for the Series 40 version of the client actually added application updates, which is of course something we've enjoyed in the Symbian version for a while. But there was some question at the time of the Microsoft announcement what would happen to Ovi Store, as it was then now Nokia Store. I think we can be pretty confident it's going to continue for the Symbian devices for the next few years, obviously, but also for very important on the Series 40 devices, because the importance of apps isn't going anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. So do watch out for that, and go into betalabs.nokia.com on your smartphone is by far the easiest way. Just sign in and then you can download all the latest BetaLab stuff, including that store client. And the update process, David, I'm you're probably like me. Every once a week you go into the store and there's 3 or 4 updates and you set them all downloading. And some of them are Qt-based, which means that they have pop-ups, you know, preparing installation, finishing installation. And basically they get queued one after the other. But for me, I haven't had a single problem over the last 6 months. Same with you?
Absolutely. I mean, the only problem I've had is these pop-ups getting away with what I'm doing. But otherwise...
You know, that's another matter.
Yes. But it is all working smoothly as it should. So I think they finally nailed it.
Yeah, yes. which is great. I mean, I have to admit, I tend to just press the update button and then leave my phone to itself for sort of 5 minutes or however long it's going to take. But given the problems we've had over the years, and let's not pretend otherwise, you know, when it first launched, Ovi Store was a bit of a dog as far as the client was concerned. We didn't have things like application updates and even downloading multiple things at the same time. Now, some of that was down to failings in the way Qt was implemented, or rather it was actually in the platform itself. But they've given their due, they've worked around it, and it all works very smoothly now. And I'd actually say the Nokia Store, the App Store experience, is as good as anything you'll find elsewhere. I think people will probably talk about the content, which is fair enough. But in terms of downloads and getting the updates and paying for things, it's very good indeed. And of course, it still has much wider premium SMS or operator billing support than anything else. So, I was talking to some developers the other day, and they were saying, actually, Nokia Store is still driving a tremendous amount of downloads for them on the Symbian platform, and they didn't see any reason, you know, for that changing. And they said, you know, it has got a lot smoother. So they were sort of talking about how more casual users, the kind of addressable market of it, seemed to be increasing all the time. And that's certainly borne out by the figures. We had, you know, 11 million and now 12 million downloads a day going on. And I think that may well keep on growing as well.
Is there a technical reason, Rafe, why, you know, when you install a Qt program, you get this full screen pop-up, which, you know, starting installation, and it takes, as David says, it takes over the whole screen. You can't do anything else with your phone while it's happening. Is there a technical reason why they couldn't just make that a little pop-up at the top of the screen, just flashes up, preparing installation, you carry on with the foreground app, and later on you get finished installation of application X, and it doesn't actually get in the way at all? Why could they not do that technically? Would it take up too much resources? Would the phone be too slow?
I'm not sure there's any particular technical reason. I don't actually have an insight on this. but I suspect it's to do with the way the sort of security frameworks work when you're doing this kind of thing on the platform level. So I suspect it's a platform limitation rather than anything to do with Qt and just the way things are set to pop up. You'll remember in the past, we did actually have to click through dialogues like that. That did obviously change. And there has always been a way of silently installing things on Symbian, and it wasn't used in the initial versions of the Nokia Store. And I suspect it now is being, hence the reason it doesn't need user input. But I suspect there's still this legacy sitting there from the old days. And it's kind of one of the issues with the Symbian platform is this kind of thing does sit there. And I kind of spoke about the way they had to work around things. That kind of does speak to the legacy nature of the Symbian platform. What I mean by that is it's been around, and so some of the way things are done are really designed for the way smartphones and the sort of thoughts about how things should work from, you know, a decade ago. Now, some of that you can update fairly easily. We've seen the UI being updated with something like Bell, but some things it's probably less easy to do because they're just the way things are implemented in terms of system functionality. But that's probably a long-winded way of saying I don't really know, but I suspect if they could get rid of it, they would, given all the other changes they've made.
Now, on the site, I have done several editorials talking about battery capacity and battery life, and basically what happens a year or two down the line when your N8 or your E7 or your X7 or whatever is basically a bit old and tired, and the battery in it is down to about 30-40% capacity, and you can't switch in a new battery yourself because it's not user replaceable. Now, David has a new favorite TV channel. It's called the Phone Repair TV channel, and you've been watching some of the videos. And I flowed this yesterday, Rafe and David, on All About Symbian, some jaw-droppingly risky close-up videos of the X7, the E7, the C601, all be basically taken apart and dismembered. And in the E7's case, being able to change the battery with the... He did it in about 5 or 6 minutes. David, what did you take away from these videos?
The thing that I found when I was watching them, I was just fascinated by the intricacy of the phone designs, and it actually made me want to learn more about...
disassembly.
and the engineering of it all. It's but yes, I think the other thing to take away from watching these is that there is a lot that can go wrong. So I think... Yeah, just because there's a bloke doing it on YouTube does not mean that you should probably think, oh, well, I can do this and I'll have a go at it. Although there are probably some of us who I think will. And I was watching it and I was thinking, while Steve may not try to replace the Lumia 800 screen, I'm sure now he's watched this, he is going to try replacing the E7 battery. And I think you are, aren't you?
I will when it's out of warranty. At the moment, I think I'm probably just slightly in warranty. And if we should have a huge disclaimer over all of this. All three of us have enjoyed watching the videos. I'm sure the readers of the site have as well. They're really, really well done, as you'll appreciate when you see them for yourself. But the vast majority of Symbian 3 and Symbian Anaphones will probably still be in warranty. And someone did say, Rafe, that in the comments that there's now new EU regulations whereby I think most products are now on an implicit 24-month, by a two-year warranty. So before taking, for example, E7 to bits, you should perhaps contact Nokia and say, look, I demand my consumer rights. This battery is not performing. Please change it for me.
Yes, absolutely. You should definitely only do this at your own risk. I mean, I've taken phones apart, and when I put them back together again, they squeaked or didn't work quite properly. But nonetheless, it's interesting to see the innards. And I've actually seen several Nokia technicians and people take apart phones in literally, 30 seconds because they know exactly what they're doing. But I think most people don't have that kind of experience, so it's probably not worth taking the risk. And I think David's words there of just because someone on YouTube's doing doesn't mean it's a good idea is probably words to live by, if I'm completely honest.
Yes, especially if it involves wings or skateboards. The other thing, I mean, to take from this is that the guy doing the videos did keep emphasizing about having a good quality screwdriver. And that's the other reason why, not just to do it because someone else on YouTube can do it. You do have to have the right tools, because it is so, so easy to strip the heads out of these screws. Because I know myself, many years ago, my E51 needed fixing, took it to Carphone Warehouse, got it back a few weeks later. It was in a terrible state, so I felt like I needed to take it upon myself to repair the repair. And I stripped out a load of screws in that, and it's still waiting for me to take a pair of pliers to it just to try and swap out some of the screws in it, because I didn't have a good enough screwdriver. So that So like Rafe said, if you do take your own stuff apart, there's a very good chance it isn't going to go back together quite as well as it did, unless you have experience and the right tools.
That's right. Everyone thinks they're superb at DIY, but I've also stripped the heads off. I think it was my E71 when I was putting it back together again after I'd taken it apart, after dropping it in a stream. And it's still working fine, but the screen has got a noticeable squeak to it. And also sometimes the screw heads are sort of specially designed as well. Nonetheless, with all of this, it is quite interesting. We think about these devices quite well built, and especially some of the recent Nokia devices, you know, feel like you could hit nails in with them, and very solid build quality. But what always surprises me when I see people taking devices apart is quite often it's just a question of a few screws that you need to undo, and then everything will sort of peel apart bit by bit. And the other thing that always strikes me is just how small the actual brains of the device are in terms of the, if you like, the chips and the circuits that have all the important bits in it are a tiny, tiny portion of the phone. And you kind of wonder where it actually all fits, especially when you get down to the size of the processor, because the vast majority of the space is actually taken up by the battery, of course, and then other bits like the camera module, but also the USB port and the 3.5mm audio port, they're all really big. I mean, when I'm talking about small, it's probably 10% of the innards, maybe, of the actual circuit board, something like that. And obviously, it does vary from device to device. And sometimes the circuit board itself will be bigger because it's used as an integral part of the structure. You know, it actually helps hold the device together. But as David said, one of the things that always stands out about this is just how well designed these devices are, and just how intricate everything is. And when you consider these all have to be placed carefully, the internal components, to avoid them interfering with each other, it really is a miracle of micro-engineering when you look inside one of these modern devices with the size shrunk down, everything that's in there, everything they're capable of, and a lot of work and effort goes into it. So you can take it apart and appreciate that, but probably for most people, don't take your device apart, take it down the service centre.
Yeah, don't do what we actually do. I mean, I've taken my N8 apart. People know that. I've changed the battery numerous times. I once did it in the dark with David at Nokia World last year. The Nokia E71 I took to bits recently, trying to repair an old E71, and I just about got it back together again. Rafe, it's quite well built inside, and like you, it doesn't quite look and feel the same as it did before the repair, and nothing quite lines up, and the keypad kind of raises up and bubbles a bit, but there we go. David?
Yeah, I'd just like to reaffirm what you were saying about doing the N8. Yes, I did bear witness to this, and I was quite in awe of it. And I think it was also something you see in movies where soldiers are being trained and they have to put a blindfold on and be able to strip down and reassemble their gun. I think what you did there at Nokia World while we were in that keynote talk and you were there with a screwdriver doing that, and I was just sat there typing, watching you. I think it was just like the geek equivalent of that. So I was like, props to you.
I'm also getting quite good at taking my Nokia E6 to bits, basically because there's definitely a design problem with this particular design, Rafe, because it's got a backlit LCD screen. I think there's the backlight creates quite a bit of static, which attracts dust. And I think my particular unit, there must be a gap in the sealant around the screen, which basically means that it just collects dust. And it just annoys me. Every time the screen's off and I look at the phone, I can see this dust building up. And every once a month or so, I have to take the entire thing apart and clean up the screens. But
the seal has been affected by you taking it apart all the time. So maybe it's got a bigger gap now.
Well, I took it apart in the first place because of the dust, so there must have been a defect in the seal, so that's my excuse. But anyway, I've got it down to about 5 minutes now, so if anyone wants E6 instructions for an out-of-warranty device, we should emphasise, if it's in warranty, and most devices are, do go find a Nokia CarePoint, because they'll do a much better job than you will.
If not, you can...
Notice that when I've seen service staff at work, and for example, when they have to take a device apart to change the battery, they take out the screws, and they peel off the little sticky bits that cover the screws. They then throw all of those away. They throw all of the screws away because the new parts they put in, i.e. the new battery, they're a proper kit from Nokia, which includes fresh screws, fresh sticky bits, because Nokia themselves know that the screws will be damaged even slightly, even by proper service center staff with their good tools. They will be damaged. So they basically give them new screws every time. And of course, if you're constantly taking your own device apart, right, left, and center, those screws are going to get more and more and more worn. So again, heavy caveats, heavy disclaimers. Now, here's an interesting story. Around the world on one E6 battery. This was some from a chap called, I forget his name now, but from the Polish Jules Verne Society. We've got the story up on the site, allaboutsymbian.com. entitled Around the World on One E6 Battery. And basically, he took an E6 fully charged from London, basically replicating the old Jules Verne Around the World in 80 Days trip. And the idea was to fly around the world, shooting video and photographs and doing social reporting on the E6, all without charging it. It took him about a week. He got back to London with 0% left, but the phone was still working and the display was still on. And I guess the question is, Rafe, people have said this is all a bit of a put-up. Did he really do this? Surely that's not possible. Surely he had it turned off most of the time. I think it could be done as long as he had it perhaps in GSM mode and in flight mode throughout all the aircraft travel, and of course probably turned off at night while he slept. I think he could just about have done it. I think this is all for real.
Yes, I think it's entirely possible. The reason I say this is I quite often have my E6 sitting on my desk, and you know, a 4 or 5 day period will go past without me picking it up because I'm using a 701 or I'm using a Windows phone device, and I'll come back to it and it's still going strong. It's, I think, of all the phones I've had, and actually it really applies to all these QWERTY E-series devices, they seem to have incredibly good battery life. Now, partly it's the BP4L battery in them, 1500 milliamp hours, but I don't know if there's any other tweaking in the settings to give them extra life. I mean, the other thing is if you put it into battery saver mode or in this low energy use, you can make the battery last even longer. I mean, the thing that kind of makes me slightly suspicious is recording pictures and video, that can drain the battery. However, if you're keeping them relatively short, you know, yes, you'll be able to do that just fine. It depends how many he took. I mean, I had a look at the video and it doesn't give too many clues away. But yes, I think this is possible. And particularly with things like the flights, it was probably in flight mode. And at that point, I have no trouble believing that the E6 is capable of doing sort of 10 days in sort of a standby mode, in, you know, in flight mode, so none of the radios on, without any problem. And then sort of if you reduce that down to a week with just bringing it up every now and then to do a few things, it's possible. I think the reality is if you're using it in the real world, kind of day-to-day use as a normal person would, I would say the E6 for me always gets 2 days and will sometimes do 3 days. And that's kind of a testament both to the Symbian platform itself and its power consumption characteristics, but also obviously the big battery in the E6.
Yeah, and other settings that I only tend to find in Symbian, well, that's not fair to say, but you can do in Symbian. You can keep the screen brightness down and you cannot use dual mode radio, so either stick to 3G or GPRS, or just stick preferably GPRS, much less NG intensive, as long as you can be patient with your emos and just little tweaks like that. But you can just save a battery life with. And to be fair, you can do things like that in, say, Android as well, but I think it's a tip of the iceberg with Android. So
yeah, I think the impact you have on Android with, I mean, make no mistake about it, you can probably double the battery life, but you're probably doubling from 6 hours to 12 hours if you're going from completely unoptimized to very well optimized. I mean, the big capacity Android devices, like, I think it's the Motorola Max, for example. Yes, I think you can probably get 2 days out of them, but you're talking about a 3,000 milliamp hour battery. whereas actually, I think if you tune Symbian for, you know, saving battery, you can actually monitor this through an application called Energy Profiler, which is available from Forum Nokia, and you can actually see each action you take, so dropping down the amount of power that the device is using. And yes, screen brightness is a very good tip, and particularly going from the maximum to the minimum, and also what David was talking about there in terms of radios. But I think the big thing for Symbian is probably it is less of an always-on device compared to something like OS, Android, or Windows Phone, and so it's just making less data connections. Now, obviously, if you've got your Symbian device configured for something like push email or some other push notification, that's going to change, but it does seem very efficient in the way it batches communications, for example, so it does them in a burst rather than continuously, and that can save power. But I think it's probably the characteristic of Symbian devices to not necessarily be always on by default, as the sort of competing platforms are, which probably gives it the real big boost in terms of power consumption. And of course, you know, it is running on less resources in terms of RAM and processor and things like that as well.
Yeah, I think actually when I started using push email on my E72, I didn't notice that much of a hit in battery life. And actually, I think push email is going to be more efficient than sort of scheduled purling emails. Say if you have IMAP and set it to check once an hour or something. At least with push, the network knows you're online, and when it gets when the network gets a notification of the email, it pings your phone, so your phone is not constantly purling your email server across the internet.
Yeah, that's right, David. It obviously depends on the setup of the email and the individual circumstances, but manufacturers and software providers go to a lot of trouble to make push email as efficient as possible in terms of energy consumption. That's obviously because it's one of the well-known use cases. I think some setups are worse. So, for example, a third-party application polling Twitter, or maybe an instant messaging program, they can be worse. I mean, there's no doubt that in terms of energy consumption, doing a connection to the network, the internet, is by far the most energy-draining thing a smartphone can do. You know, people assume that the specification of the processor or the RAM makes a big difference. And yes, obviously it has an impact, but proportionally it's relatively small and it's usually dwarfed by data concerns. Screen can be another one, but again, perhaps not as obvious as people might think. Actually, screen technology can have a bigger difference, AMOLED versus LCD, and depending on what you're actually looking at on the screen. Steve's talked a lot about that in the past, but it does tend to be the data connections that make the difference, which is why I was talking about sort of always on platforms in terms of connectivity versus something like Symbian, which was designed in a different age where there was an assumption you wouldn't always have a data connection.
Yeah, and we had that point driven home in the news last week, because there was the study that in-app advertising is consuming 80% of the energy that an app consumes, and because they are constantly pulling advertising images and HTML code down from an advertising server. And it's like with an old Zone phone, like a Windows phone device. I mean, it's a symptom of being a geek, but I know it's always on and I know it's always bleeding energy, and that creates a certain amount of anxiety too.
That's right. I mean, one of the nice features of Windows Phone, and actually all the platforms have an equivalent to this, and you can actually talk about this on a piece on All About Windows Phone if people want to go and look at it, is Battery Saver, which works much as the way as with Symbian, and basically it switches off all the data connections. And I've noticed if you use a Windows Phone device in that time, actually the battery life is pretty fantastic. And it just sort of proves this point. But yes, this study that David's talking about, I think it was done out of Purdue University in the US with some backing from Microsoft. Some people might be skeptical about it. I mean, it's actually was based on Windows Mobile 6.5 and Android. But actually, I don't really think the platform is relevant here. It's really about the effect of the various energy components within an application itself. And as David says, advertising was the big one. You can tell by looking at the actual threads running in an application, the separate components. And it was pretty obvious that adverts were doing it. And this particular study looked at Angry Birds, and that's where the 80% figure came from. Now, obviously, it will vary between application, but the sort of inescapable conclusion is that ad-supported applications are rather energy hogs and will drain your battery faster than anything else. And it does make me wonder whether, you know, for something like Android, which I think it's fair to say is probably has more ad-supported applications than a lot of the other platforms because of the, so it's not an unwillingness to pay for applications, but there has been this free thing, and also the number of markets where you can actually buy an application has been relatively limited until recently. I wonder whether that's given Android some of its reputation for poor, you know, battery life. And so the question I think is kind of interesting, it comes out of this, is if you could quantify that effect on battery life, would you be happier about paying for a premium application without ads? And I've got to say, if there's an application or a game I regularly use, I will very happily stump up £1, £2, or even £3 to get rid of the ads. Actually, it's more because the ads irritate my sort of sense of aesthetics.
Yeah.
But actually, it's probably a better reason to do it is because I want my battery to last longer. So,
yes.
Steve, I mean, would you what side would you fall down on?
Absolutely, yes. There are several games which I've tried the free versions and I've loved them. And not only do I want to get rid of the ads, not only do I want to improve my battery life, not only do I want to improve my aesthetic sensibilities, not having ads floating around, I want to support the developer and I want them to get sales out of it and get money out of it and thereby produce updates and support and more applications in the future. So very definitely.
And how about you, David?
Yeah, I feel exactly the same as Steve, and I am buying a lot of apps these days. I'm quite happy about doing it, and it's I'd rather spend a bit of money than not have the stress of the battery draining down all the time as well. So it is money well spent.
And I think a lot of people listening to this podcast will have exactly the same attitude. But in the wider world, I think people like having a free lunch and they don't necessarily think about the impact it might have on battery life. And I think that's perfectly understandable. And also, as I said, there are plenty of markets where an app store doesn't actually support commercial transaction. And so ad-supported is the only choice for developers looking for a revenue stream. And talking to developers, it's quite clear that if you want volume downloads, ad-supported is the way to go. In terms of, obviously, money per customer, in almost all cases, a premium paid-for application will be better. I mean, I've heard figures, you know, between 10 and 25 pence or 10 and 25 cents in terms of money you can expect to make off an ad for a user now. It's going to vary greatly between applications because it depends what sort of game or app is, how often it gets used, whether they're clicking on the ads and all of that kind of thing. But in general, I've heard a figure of somewhere around 10 to 1 in terms of the revenue between the two. But I think this is an issue that will become more important as battery life becomes more of an issue, because this isn't going to go away as people download more apps and expect their phones to do more and more. And battery technology is certainly not increasing at the same rate. And I don't really expect any major developments in the next few years. I mean, I'd like a black swan to come out of nowhere and improve battery life. And there's certainly things that have been worked on in the labs, and we'll see something eventually. But I don't think battery life is ever going to quite keep pace with what people expect their phones to do.
And I think also we should acknowledge something just to qualify what we were all saying. I mean, we've all unanimously come across as saying we are happy to hand over money for our apps, and we're not going to go for free lunch. We want to support the developers. But that is only because of how things are now these days. I mean, it wasn't that long ago when if you changed your device, you'd have to rebuy the application. Or even going back a little bit further, if there was a new major version, they would charge for the new, you would have to buy the new version or you would stay on the old version. It's only now that we spend that relatively small amount of money and feel safe in that purchase that we are happy to say, oh, well, I'd rather spend money than save my battery life.
That's right. And of course, I mean, if I'm honest, looking through the application on my phone right now, of the ones that I could upgrade, if you like, I've probably only done it on about 25% of them. They're the ones that I kind of use regularly and become regular things. There's plenty of apps on my phone which I might refer to as disposable, which I might play for a few weeks or even a few months, or have sitting on there and I've not used for ages, but I will eventually delete. So even with this kind of willingness to pay, if you like, there are still going to be plenty of circumstances when I'm using an ad-supported app for some time. And yes, that's going to have an impact on my battery life.
Yeah, we seem to have wandered from the original story. That's fine. It's been an interesting discussion. We were talking about around the world and one E6 battery. And just a final comment on that before we move on. I remember when the E71 came out, Ray, which is the same kind of design as the E6, but with, obviously, the lower resolution quarter VGA screen. People were saying in testing they'd got a week on normal use on one battery charge. Now, presumably that was with the brightness turned down, and presumably that was and GSM, not 3G. But even so, if the E71 can last a week, then maybe the E6 with careful use can do the same. And like you, when I've used the E6, I've got easily two days of hard use out of it. And as you say, you could probably stretch it out to 3 or 4 if you were really, really careful. So anyway, it's a great stunt from Nokia, great stunt from this Jules Verne Polish society, and great to see the video up on the site, so do go and watch that. Talking of E-Series, I did a piece pimping the E7 communicator. Now, quite apart from the question, would it actually make you think, oh, yes, that was a great device with all those tweaks, it would work well for me. Just David, did my article make you want the E7 anymore as your main device?
I'm sorry it didn't, although I think it was a great set of updates to do. I think that these are all the things that everyone should do with it. I think for me, it's just for size, and the keyboard just still put me off the device, because obviously I'm still going to have to hold the device in my hand and use the keyboard to do all of these things, and it wasn't quite enough to tempt me over.
Rafe?
Well, I've always liked the E7, and despite Nasty Steve excluding it from the top 10 QWERTY devices...
Ooh, hiss!
Yes, 10 days ago, when I thought it should be there. So I already had a soft spot for the E7, and I read through this list of tips and sort of found myself nodding and sort of think, yes, that's the way you want to pimp it. Although I will say, I think on almost all of the tips related to software, at least, you could apply them to any of the Symbian 3 devices with AMOLED screens, which is obviously most of the first generation, and you'll be able to improve it. So did it make me want the E7 anymore? Probably not. I mean, I wanted it in the first place, and maybe I'm more aware of some of these pimping tips that Steve's implemented. And I would recommend it. I mean, these articles are always popular. We always get lots of comments on them. But yes, I suspect those who have set in their ways about not liking the E7, like Steve, it's not going to make any difference. But for people like me who regard the E7 as kind of the last communicator, they're not going to start loving it anymore.
I use the E7 every single day, I'll have you know. I use it as my main video phone for my capturing the phone show. I use it for virtually all the reviews I do for All About Symbian. It's my main test phone. So I do use it every day. Just this huge elephant in the room with the battery was what holds me back at using it day-to-day device. And that's why making the pimping thing center around improving power performance and improving longer-term battery capacity was the thing I had to address. David?
Yeah, well, I think actually you need to go back to your pimping the E7 article now and include the battery replacement video.
I'm not going to recommend anyone tries that. That was one of the more scary ones, only slightly less scary than taking the Lumia 800 to bits right down to its last plastic nipple, so which was just utterly scary when he had about 50 bits all scattered around his desk. And I thought, it's not about how difficult it is to get each individual bit out. It's that when you've got 50 bits scattered around your desk, how the heck do you work out which bit goes where when you want to put it back together again? So, I'm not putting that in my next pimping piece. There was a debate over whether I should even call it the E7 communicator at all. Now, people have said that the communicator term sort of died with the E90. Rafe, was I assigning that term wrongly?
I don't think so. I mean, I get what people mean when they comment like that, but ultimately devices do evolve over time. And yes, in some ways, the E7 isn't as capable as the early communicators. I can remember, I think actually this applied to the E90 as well, a passionate user decrying the fact that there was no longer fax functionality built in. And this is something they'd used since the very earliest communicators and couldn't believe that Nokia had missed it out. And I actually went to the trouble to ask a product manager about this. And they said, well, yes, we knew that was going to cause trouble because there's about 0.05% of users who really are into that particular functionality and they run their businesses off it. And so, you know, we thought, do we include it? And they just couldn't justify it on the economic case. And understandably, because I think faxes have probably gone the way of the dodo for the most part. And so I have this feeling that devices should always evolve. With the communicator is tricky because people were particularly loyal and passionate about it. It was one of these devices that I think the first fanboys all owned communicators, and they've since dispersed throughout the mobile phone ecosystem. But yes, I would still apply the communicator label to it because for me it's about the form factor, about the design of the device and kind of the ethos of what you do with it rather than any one specific piece of functionality.
Yeah, David?
Well, I always found the communicator title somewhat questionable anyway. It's like, where do you draw the line? You can communicate with all of them. In terms of fax functionality, I really think fax is an outmoded way of doing things now. And there's probably a lot of small business owners that like screaming at me now. But I mean, there are other ways to do faxes. As long as you have a PDF, pre-made PDF document on your device, you can upload to a web service, for example. But in terms of the form factor and the general office productivity functionality, yes, the E7 is a communicator, just like the old ones.
I think of a communicator, and I think of the form factor, just like Rafe. I think of it sitting there in sort of laptop fashion with the screen propped up and the keyboard always available, and that's what makes me apply the term communicator, because it sits there just like my 9210 did, just like the 9500 did, just like the E90 did. So I'm going to stick with calling it that. I'm sorry, commenters, if you hate it. I'm going to carry on. We've just got a bit of time left. We're running a bit late. But David, Word Tiles, multi-user, over the internet, Scrabble-like game. Is it any good? And do you think the Hasbro lawyers will be hassling Word Tiles developer over this?
Well, I think for the Hasbro lawyers, that horse has already bolted. Scrabble, it's one of the most imitated online games because we've got Words with Friends and Word Feud. Unfortunately, none of those have come to Symbian, which is where Word Tiles steps in. It's the same sort of idea. I mean, you have your double and triple letter scores and double and triple word scores. They're just arranged in a slightly different pattern, but it's still basically the same game, and you can play with either a friend on the online if you have their username, you can play with a random opponent on the internet, which is what I was doing when I was testing, or you can play a local game by just like passing it back and forth with a friend or loved one. But the thing is, It's free and it works just the same. So if you like to flex your spelling muscles and you want to be able to play things like Words with Friends on your Sunbeam device, there's no other option, and I really enjoy playing this. And also, it's the only title I've come across that supports push notifications on Nokia Bell.
Oh, yes, on the new notifications drop-down. Well done, yeah. How are the developers going to monetize this, David? How is it possible that it's completely free?
At the moment, I think they're probably just testing and studying feedback and bug reports. I mean, the version I tested was only version 1. I mean, they may be doing it as a labor of love, but I would expect to see ads appear at some point.
Okay. Also, appearing in the last week or so, just to mention it briefly, was an update to Nokia Internet Radio, which makes it fully compatible with Nokia Bell, it was already, but even more so, and certainly more compatible with things like FM transmission and Bluetooth A2DP, so you can actually receive your internet radio and then broadcast it out again, and that works much more reliably now. So if you're a big fan of internet radio, like my good friend Mr. Rafe Lanford, go and grab the update from the Nokia store, and you'll be a very happy Benny. Maybe we'll come back to that next time, Rafe, and cover that in more detail.
Yes.
We are out of time for this podcast, though. We have to rush off and do more writing. So in the meantime, it's goodbye from Mr. David Gilson.
Goodbye, everybody. Thank you for listening, and talk to you next week.
And a goodbye from the head honcho himself, Mr. Rafe Blandford.
Goodbye, everybody. Thanks for listening, and talk to you all next week. Oh, sorry, Steve.
Yeah, I was going to say, though, there's no sign of Ewan today. I think he's busy beavering away on allaboutwindowsphone.com, so that's where he is. But, in the meantime, it's goodbye from me, Steve Litchfield, as well. We will catch you next time on the All About Symbian Inside podcast.